You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 11th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the Harold E. Worth, eminent scholar, endowed chair in economics at Loyola University, part of the business school, Dr. Walter Block will be with us today. Also on the program, three Muslim students gunned down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Unclear as to what the motivation was. Also on the program, Brian Williams, six-month vacation. Jon Stewart announces he's going to take a permanent vacation from The Daily Show. Also, the Obama administration, the first administration in 13 years seeking, under the War Powers Act, a authorization of military force. Well, I guess it was his in the last 13 years, not so long, to fight ISIS. And Jeb Bush loses a chief technological officer, and I don't know if he had a title, but bigot also seems appropriate. Reports that FBI targeting Keystone protesters, and David Axelrod's book says that Obama was lying about gay marriage. I have something to add to that as well. And West Virginia lawmakers seeking to allow for more toxins in their water supply after tightening up regulations following the leak of toxins into their water supply. Because you don't want your water to be too clean, ladies and gentlemen. Folks, thank you for your indulgence in my absence yesterday. I hope you enjoyed that pre-taped interview. Just some house cleaning. It appears now that the podcast of voting will not take place for at least another week and a half or so. I guess they're going to announce on February 23rd the slate of nominees, so we will tell you to when to vote for us. Next week, we have a this is what happened with next week. I generally take vacation on when Mila has vacation from her school. That way we don't have to deal with child care and whatnot. And Nikki's working next week. She does not she's not able to take vacation. But Mila is now severely PO'd at me because it appears I'm going to be doing Mark Maron's television program. And I'll go into in the better half just what she said to me. It was actually mildly amusing for people who like to hear stories of a nine-year-old trying to take down her significantly older father. But we will have a mix of new interviews and best ofs next week for you, and some deep archive stuff for members. So we'll provide that for you, of course, next week. And you know the deal here. Professor Block has been on this program before one time. I guess it was a little bit about a year ago, maybe a little bit less. And it was quite a debate. It should be interesting to have him on once again. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Dr. Walter Block will be with us. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dr. Walter Block. He is an economist at the business school at Loyola University, a longtime libertarian as well. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, just to catch up new listeners to this program, we had a debate, I guess now it was back in May of last year. And, I want to just clear the air of one thing, and that was that I think at the time you felt that I didn't quite give you as much time as I wasn't quite fair with doling out the time, I guess, in the context of our debate slash interview conversation. And I just wanted to say that one of our listeners, whose handle is Fred at Conn College, who I think we actually may get as an intern, did a breakdown of our of a comparative analysis of talking times during our debate from that day, and we've linked to it on the site. But I think you'll find that you did okay, and I hope to provide a similar breakdown this time.
I really have no problem. If I thought I was being treated vastly unfairly, I wouldn't be back on your program. So I guess my own comfort level is, you know, more formal. You know, you get 5 minutes, I get 5 minutes, you get 3 minutes, I get 3 minutes. But I'm happy to have a conversation with you. And in retrospect, I don't think I was really dealt with unfairly. And as I say, if I really thought that, I wouldn't be here now. So no problem.
Great. I'm glad that was your feeling. Now, I want to start off with a question that has actually been posed by a listener of this program who calls in quite a bit, and he is a bit of a self-identified libertarian. And he had a question for you, which I thought was a good way to start off, just so that, because one of the challenges I've had with taking phone calls from libertarians is that maybe every is an exaggeration, but nearly all libertarians who call into this program say that the other libertarians who have called into this program are not really libertarians. And so the question that he poses is, what's the difference between consequentialist and deontological libertarianism, and which one are you?
Right. You know, the joke among libertarian circles is if you get 10 libertarians in a room on any given issue, you'll have 11 different opinions. Another one is organized libertarians, sort of like herding cats. It can't be done. I'm a professor. I'm never supposed to answer questions exactly or on point. So let me deviate a little bit from your question, although I will answer it. There are four kinds of libertarians in my view, and deontological versus utilitarian or consequentialist is only is sort of a different a dimension of distinction between libertarians. The main differences, as I see it, between libertarians is there are four. The first one is anarcho-capitalist, of which I'm one, and we say that the essence of libertarianism is the non-aggression principle. Keep your mitts to yourself. Don't invade or aggress against anyone else. And since the government necessarily does it, we're all anarchists. The second group, and I guess the most famous people there would be Murray Rothbard. The second group would be minarchists, minimal government libertarians, and the most famous people there would be Ayn Rand and Robert Nozick, and they also adhere to the non-aggression principle, as do all libertarians, but I don't think they're as logically consistent. And what they say is that we should have minimal government, and the government should just have armies to keep foreign bad guys off of us, police to keep local bad guys off of us, and courts to determine who the good guys and the bad guys are. The third group, and I'm in descending order in terms of purity in my view, the third one would be constitutionalist libertarians like Ron Paul, who believe in the U.S. Constitution, and I would even include Rand Paul in this too, and pretty much anything the Constitution says is what libertarianism is all about. And the fourth group I would call classical liberals, Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. Those people certainly agree with minimal government, night watchman libertarianism, but they would add more welfare programs, vouchers, other things like that. So that would be the four breakdowns. So if you heard from any one of those four, the other three would say, well, he's not really a libertarian. Whereas in my view, they're all libertarians. Libertarianism is a many splendored thing. There are many mansions, and I'm a big tent kind of a guy. Now, to answer your question finally, the difference between consequentialist and deontological libertarianism is a consequentialist is sort of like utilitarian. What the consequentialist or utilitarian libertarians say is, if you follow the non-aggression principle, that's the route to human happiness. We'll all be happier if people keep their mitts to themselves and government is either non-existent or very limited. Whereas the deontological libertarians are much more logical. It's not that the other people are illogical, but it's based on logic. Namely, we deduce from the non-aggression principle plus homesteading for private property rights, and wherever that leads us, even, justice though the heavens fall, we don't care about utility. We only care about rights. So the deontological libertarian would talk about rights, and the utilitarian or consequentialist libertarian would talk about human happiness also as emanating from the non-aggression principle.
And you are a consequentialist, is that it?
No, I'm a deontological libertarian, and I'm also an anarcho-capitalist. So there are two different dimensions, so to speak, and those are my two positions.
So let me ask you about this. I mean, just in terms of the non-aggression principle, how in the world that you imagine, how does one maintain property rights?
Well, in my view as a anarcho-capitalist, there would be private defense agencies that had police forces or armies. And if you stole my wallet, for example, let's say, and my wallet is legitimately mine, I would call the police. I would call the private police agency, and they would come get you and, you know, make you disgorge the wallet and punish you according to libertarian punishment theory. If I were a minarchist, I would just call the government, and I'd say, hey, Sam stole my wallet. Go get him. And if Sam said, no, I didn't really steal it, then we would have to adjudicate it through the court.
Now, so in... Well, okay, that raises a couple of questions for me. I mean, the first being that, I mean, who gets to determine if you're not a minarchist A minarchist. If you're not a minarchist, who gets to determine whether or not I really stole your wallet?
Well, we would have a series of competing courts. And let's suppose you deny that you stole the wallet. You claim that I stole it from you yesterday and you're just repossessing it or something like that. Well, you would go to your court, call it Court A, Mm-hmm. And he would invite me to go to Court A, and I'd say, what, Court A? That's your brother or your mother. I'm not going to Court A. And I would go to Court F as in Frank. And I would invite you to come to my court. And you say, what? Court F? That's your mother, your brother, your friend, whatever. I'm not going. And and then we would each go to our own courts. And now it's possible that both, and when you go to a court, you sign an agreement that you'll obey or abide by what the court says. Now it's possible that both courts will agree with you. In which case, it's sort of case closed. You know, both courts and police will, you know, come after me because they both agreed with you. Or vice versa, it's possible that both courts will agree with me, in which case, you know, you'd better give me that wallet back because not only my court, but your court, dash police, will come after you. Okay, so the more interesting case is suppose the courts disagree. Now, one possibility, which we won't consider, is that my court agrees with you and your court agrees with me. Let's forget about that for the moment. And let's assume that your court agrees with you and my court agrees with me. Now, Ayn Rand, who is a minarchist, says at this point, blank out, you know, you anarchist libertarians. By the way, the debates among libertarians are pretty ferocious. She says, blank out. Then what happens? You know, the courts fight. And the answer to that, coming from my quarter of libertarianism, is no. There are two types of courts. One type of court, we call them legitimate courts, are courts that will anticipate Court A and Court F will recognize each other as courts and will say, look, you know, if ever we come up with a dispute and we come up on the opposite side of this dispute, let's go to Court C, as in trolley, or take a random number. You know, we'll have 15 courts that we all agree are legitimate courts, and we'll pick one of them, and their decision will be final, and that'll settle it. On the other hand, there might be bandit courts. Bandit courts are either too stupid to realize that they might be on opposite sides of an issue, or they say, I don't care, you know, my way or the highway. And the point is that the bandit courts would have to fight everyone. They would have to fight other bandit courts and legitimate courts, whereas the legitimate courts would only have to fight bandit courts. And the point is that fighting is expensive. They'd have to pay more for their soldiers or their policemen. And presumably they would, you know, go the way of the dodo bird. We wouldn't have too many of them, or at least it wouldn't be as bad as present government. So that's how it would be settled if you and I had a dispute as to whose wallet it was.
So wait, so
take this paradigm case, the property rights.
All right, so let me see if I understand this. In the scenario where my court is not one of those courts that agrees to subsume its authority to Court C, right? Not your court, but a court that we mutually agree upon that would adjudicate our discrepancy.
Yes.
Assuming that my court is not one of those, really its legitimacy is just simply a function of how big of an army I have.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a function of how big the army is.
Or how much money I have, because you're saying that I would have to fight everybody and it would go the way of the dodo board if I don't have a dodo bird, if I don't have enough money to support that army that could fight everybody.
Well, I don't think it's either a matter of guns or money. I think the pen is mightier than the sword because the pen determines in which way the sword is pointed. And I think legitimacy is very important. And, you know, the whole society would look upon your court, not you, but your court as sort of as a bandit court and wouldn't have much legitimacy. I mean, even the mafia had some sort of legitimacy.
Okay, but let's say it doesn't. Let's say the society says, we're not going to legitimize your court. And I say, okay, I don't care. I didn't steal your wallet, according to my court, which I think is actually the only legitimate court. Then what happens?
Then it's war. Then we have a little bit of a fight.
So, I mean, I guess for me, what you're outlining is sort of like feudalism to me, right? I mean, and even before we get to that point, what's interesting to me is this notion of like just the idea that you could, I mean, we call it a wallet, but let's say, a house, or let's say not even a house, a piece of land, something that existed before you claimed ownership to it. When you claim ownership to something, aren't you basically just saying like, I have a legitimate right to exercise violence in the protection of this area that I have claimed for myself? And you've just sort of, I mean, that seems to me to be contrary to your non-aggression principle.
Well, I would offer you a friendly amendment. It's not so much feudalism. What you should have said is more Hobbesian, you know, Hobbes, where it's a war of all against all. I imagine you'll accept that as a friendly amendment. Feudalism wasn't that warlike because the king would sort of tell the dukes to, you know, shut up or something.
I imagine that's what would happen, though, in this scenario, right? I mean, because that's what you were saying is that if we didn't agree to Court C, well, Court C, it sounds like to me, is the king. You and I are the dukes. And there may be other courts that we function in that way, but whatever. I mean, let's continue.
Well, I was just offering a friendly amendment that, you know, it's really the Hobbesian world that you're alluding to, not so much the feudal. But if you want to stick to feudal, that's okay. And also, I agree with you, it doesn't really matter whether it's a wallet or a house or land or anything. I was just using as a wallet as a paradigm case of property that people could dispute over. But I disagree with you. And by the way, this debate that we're now having is a ferocious debate within libertarianism between the minarchists and the anarchists. And you are taking the minarchist point of view. And I will now take the anarchist point of view and say, look, the logical implication of your minarchist libertarian view, I'm glad I've converted you to minarchist libertarianism. I'm just kidding. Right now, the China and Colombia are in a state of anarchy with each other. Right now, Brazil and Burundi are in a state of anarchy with each other. Right now, the U.S. and, Australia are in a state of anarchy because there's no world government. And logically, your position, if you say, well, you know, if we have decentralized court, the police systems, you're going to have a Hobbesian or a feudal world. Well, the logical implication of that is we have to have a world government. Because if you're afraid that Court A and F will not abide by Court C, and each one will say, my way or the highway, or, you know, I'm right and the hell with you, well, then we really need a world government, because right now there's anarchy between, I don't know, about 250 countries. And yet, of course, there's a problem with world government. Namely, we're both Jewish. And we know that Jews are wandering Jews. We wander from one place to another because, you know, one dictator doesn't like us much. At least we go somewhere else. A Hitler arises, or what's happening in France arises, and we go to Israel or the United States or somewhere else. But if there were one world government and, China and India, and if it was democratic, those two countries would have a big say, and there'd be no place for us Jews to go to. So, and I don't mean to make it just a Jewish thing, but, you know, anyone who is on the outs from the powers that be likes the fact that we have a little bit of decentralization. Whereas you minarchist libertarians, Sam, are, logically implied to favor world government, and I think that that's a problem.
Well, I mean... I don't know that you've really addressed what I said. I mean, there are. I think the world is better off for having the UN. I think that there is. I wouldn't mind actually, and I don't have a problem with the series of treaties and regimes that we have in the context of those regimes. They're not as enforceable, and sometimes they do lead to war, and I do think that's problematic. But, things like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I agree. There's only so much that in the context of international relations that we can, when we're talking about major countries, that we can create a regime that functions, and I think we're doing our best. But that doesn't really, that doesn't address the idea of property as it speaks now. I mean, when you have the ability, and in fact, you know, look, that's when it is the notion of property and national boundaries, I agree, on some level, is completely arbitrary, right? And it just so happens that's where the Chinese have enforced it through weapons, and it's the same with the United States, I guess, too. But that doesn't address my question. How does the non-aggression principle reconcile itself with the idea that you can claim ownership of something? Because it is only that ownership, that property right that you exercise, is simply basically your way of saying, I have the ability to be aggressive if you attempt to take what I have decided is mine.
Well, you're sort of, I think, veering dangerously close to the argument of might makes right and accusing me of favoring that view that might makes right. But I don't uphold that view. My view is that there's justice and there's right, and sometimes justice and righteousness lose out in the war. I mean, you know, sometimes the bad guys win, unhappily. So I don't think that might makes right. I think
where
that
do property rights come from is really what I'm asking, I think.
And
how does that not involve aggression?
Well, you know, you have to distinguish between violence and aggression, or violence and invasive aggression. I mean, libertarians are not pacifists. We don't believe, well, some might be pacifists, but you need not be a pacifist to be a libertarian. You can believe in self-defense or other defense. You know, if I come after you with a knife, you have a right to shoot me because I'm violating your property rights in your person.
But wait a second. That's what's interesting to me is that your personal integrity is a property right. That seems to me to be fairly arbitrary. I mean, if I take a knife, let's say, and walk onto your property and stab your ground, I don't think that that is the same as coming at you as a human being. But it seems like you're saying that those are the same things.
Well, I wouldn't say they're the same. I would say that they're both property rights. One is a much more important property right of mine, me, my body. And if you put a knife into my body, you're really violating a very, very important piece of my property right. On the other hand, if you just step on my lawn and maybe throw a knife into my lawn, well, yeah, I think you've also violated my property rights, but a much less important property right of mine.
Well, let me ask you this. We all – I will, for the sake of argument, call them both property rights. But one is a property right that every single human being has, which is their own person by definition.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The property right to what you consider your property, that to me seems to be not inherent in every person because every person doesn't own a piece of land. So I'm curious. It's quite obvious how the first one is arrived at because everybody is a human being. They are themselves. It's quite clear as to who they are. But how is it that you establish that you own this land without it being a function of violence?
Okay, well, let me answer it in this way, and I think that's a very important question. First, I don't know if it's a concession or not on your part. I think maybe it's not, but it's a very important point that you made that we each own ourselves, because there are people who deny this. For example, the Nazis denied that Jews and gays and Romani and blacks and non-Aryans really owned themselves. And the issue of slavery, there were some people who said that other people really don't own themselves, but we own them. And in the case of rape, the rapist, in effect, is saying to the rape victim, you know, you don't really own, or at least all the property rights in your person. I own some of them, namely the right to abuse you in this sexual way. So that's a very important point. And from this, libertarians would deduce that slavery is an abomination, that kidnapping is an abomination, that rape is an abomination. But the point is that I have a right to self-defense. So again, I'm making you the bad guy. I hope you don't mind. First, I accuse you of stealing my wallet. Now I'll accuse you of coming at me with a knife. As I did before. Now, if you come at me with a knife with the intent to stab me, you're in effect saying that I don't have a right to exist, namely that you own me, in effect, that you can determine what happens to me, and I can use violence. So libertarians are not against violence. I can use violence to ward off your attack. And so, therefore, property rights imply violence, not only property rights in land and in wallets and in houses, but even in persons. Namely, suppose that there's this African guy and there's this white person who wants to enslave him and bring him to the United States. They're both using violence, only I would say one is using justified violence, namely defensive violence, and the other is using aggressive violence. And libertarians are only against aggressive violence. So that would be one point. The other point is, well, how do you get to own non-person property or non-human property? And here, libertarians pretty much rely on John Locke, another famous philosopher, along with Hobbes. And what Locke said is, if you mix your labor with the land, you sort of imprint your personality on the land. So you go out, and you sort of homestead and you put in a crop and you take care of the land. You knock down a few trees, you get rid of a few rocks, and you put in a cornfield or something. Well, then you own that land. That would be the libertarian defense of that.
Well, there's a couple things that stick out. One is, I think that from my perspective, calling one's personhood property is really sort of a semantics game that I think falls apart when you talk about, like, my right to exist. Because when I trespass on your property, from your perspective, I'm not questioning the right of that piece of land to exist. I'm just questioning your dominance over that land, which is clearly not a part of you. But how is it? I mean, if it's simply just a question of when you mix your labor with that property, it becomes yours. Does that mean that if someone, I guess, inherits it, or if someone just, just doesn't do anything with the property, then there's no property right vested in it?
Well, no. I would say that Robert Nozick is sort of my guru or my mentor on this one. He talks about legitimate title transfers to property, and he says that any voluntary transfer is legitimate. For example, I put in this corn crop, and you domesticate a cow, and you capture the cow, and you domesticate the cow, and now you get some milk out of the cow. And now what happens, I trade you some corn for some milk, and now I own the milk even though I didn't produce it, and you own the corn even though you didn't produce that. And yet I would say, along with Nozick and every other libertarian, that I now have a legitimate title to the milk because I can trace it back to an agreement with you to trade, have this barter, and also to original homesteading. Namely, you're the legitimate owner of the milk because you domesticated the cow, and I'm the legitimate owner of the corn because I, homesteaded the cornfield. So that would be one legitimate title transfer trade. Another one would be gifts. I give some corn to you as a birthday present. Or I give my son the cornfield as inheritance. That's just a gift after death or a gift as you're passing away. Or gambling. I bet you on the Super Bowl and I lose and you get some corn. I bet you some corn against some milk. And that would be another legitimate title transfer. But the point is, suppose I now, homestead the cornfield, and then I go away for a year or so. Do I have to keep homesteading it? And that's a debate among libertarians. And in my view is, once you own it, period. And there's a very technical issue. Well, suppose you go away for 50 years, then, do you give up ownership? And I would say that's a very esoteric point among libertarians. But you can have, absentee landlords or absentee landowners. In other words, I I homestead the cornfield, and now what I do is I rent it out to you. You're my farmer person. I make an arrangement with you. I'll let you you put the corn in. It's my field, but you put the corn in, and you give me half the crop or something like that. You're a sharecropper. That would be a legitimate
Professor,
contract.
I mean, according to what you're saying, that the vast swaths of this country are illegitimately considered property.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I mean, the Native Americans.
Yes, Native. Now you've elaborated enough. You've said Native
Americans. And
American.
I would also argue that, when we're talking, accordingly, if we're using illegitimate labor, i.e. slaves, to homestead property, that also seems to be questionable.
Oh, I wouldn't say questionable. I would say very
in terms of in terms of property.
Yes, very unjustified. Now, I've had a debate with I forget the guy's name. A Jewish guy, a Second Thoughts guy. Do you know who that is?
No.
It's right at the tip of my tongue. I can't. Horowitz. I forget his first name. It has to do with reparations to black people for slavery. Now, in my view, and I think most of the Libertarians would agree with me, and I think you'd probably agree with me on property rights, what should have happened in 1865 is that they should have declared slavery ex post facto illegal, just as we did in Nuremberg trials. We should have made those slave owners slaves of the slaves, but you know they've escaped our justice because we can't go back to 1865. But what should have happened with those big plantations? Well, if there were 500 slaves on the plantation X in South Carolina somewhere, what should have happened is that the 5,000 acres should have been divided up into 500 plots, and each slave should have got I guess 10 acres or whatever the numbers come out. Instead, that plantation went to the slave owner's son. And now in South Carolina, there's some, let's say it hasn't been sold, there's some great-great-grandson of the slave owner, a white guy, who owns that plantation. And I would say that the slave, the great-grandchildren, some guy, a black guy, say, living in Harlem, who is the grandson of the slave, should, in justice, go to the court and say, hey, you know, the white grandson isn't a criminal. He's just the recipient of stolen property. But that property should go to me. And now, I think you would agree with me on that, would you not?
I think there is I think there's certainly an argument for reparations along those lines. I mean, I think but my guess, my point is that and when we talk about Native Americans as well, we're looking at an entire property regime in this country that, according to you, is illegitimate.
Yes, well, it's the same principle, only there's some slight difference, because when the white man came to North America, the estimates are that there were about 2 million Native Indians or Native persons, and right now there are, I think, 350 million people in the United States, and it's still pretty empty. The point, if you take a plane...
Well, but, I mean,
over...
we've already determined, right, that if you planted something on that soil, you own it. And so it's not even just actually living there. It sounds like anything that you've done to alter it creates your property. And it, I mean, it seems to me like everything that we have in terms of property rights in this country is illegitimate. I suppose it's possible that a small percentage of the property rights in this country are legitimate, I suppose. But it seems to me that that opens up a whole nother sort of like argument that like we could empower our government today to involve in all sorts of takings of that property in one form or another, because none of those property rights are actually legitimate in any fashion.
Well, I think you've got a very good attempt at a reductio ad absurdum of my principle, and I applaud you for it. And there are libertarians who take that exact view, but I beg to differ.
Well, show me how what breaks down in my reductio ad absurdum.
Reductio ad absurdum.
Sorry.
No problem. I mispronounce things too. It's just
sort of my
numbers.
Trademark.
Right. Okay. Well, all geniuses do this. No problem. I think that in logic, you're impeccable. You're absolutely right, and I fully agree with you. The only problem, the only caveat I have with your reductio ad absurdum is just the numbers. And I was starting in to respond to that. And the point I'm making now is right now there are 350 roughly million Americans. And if you take a plane from, St. Louis to San Francisco and you go west of Mississippi and you look down at night, the place is bloody empty. The place is empty. And even east of the Mississippi, it's not all that full. There's plenty of space. Now imagine how, and that's 350 million people, but assuming that when the white man came, there were only 2 million Indians in all of the U.S. Present territory and maybe Canada too, they couldn't occupy anything like 98% of the land. They couldn't have homesteaded all that. So what I would say is, yes, they should have, the typical Indian tribe would have a southern area. say, in Arizona, and it'd be, I don't know, 10 square miles.
Well, Professor, and then, forgive me. I mean, there's really no way for us to do this. But, I mean, we've already argued at this point, if you chop down a tree, and we know that natives cross this entire land, undoubtedly chopping down trees. Now, we could argue it's 40%. They were able to cover 40% of the country, or it could be 80% or 75%. I mean, whatever that figure is, and you increase it over time, it seems to me that let's assume that it's just a figure. You want to call it 30%? Let's call it 30%.
I want to call it a half a percent.
Really? So you don't think that they chopped a tree? I mean, you know, like when you go and homestead, you don't necessarily put a piece of corn on every single piece of that property, right? I mean, when you you don't necessarily even put a – is it just the fence, everything that's included within that fence? Or is it – do you need to put something on every square inch of that property according to the way that you legitimately acquire property? In other words,
I'm going to say something now, and I don't want you to take it in the wrong way, but I really want to give you a compliment, and I want to say that you're a very brilliant young man. I think you're younger than me, so I'll say younger young man. This is exactly the debate that libertarians involve themselves in, namely, how intensive does the farming have to be in order to count as homesteading? For example, if you put a fence around the whole United States, do you own all that's in there? No. On the other hand, do you have to put a corn plant every square inch? No. How about every square foot? Well, maybe. And eastern Mississippi, a little bit more intensive than western Mississippi, because eastern Mississippi, more.
Is this really,
water, you know.
Professor, be honest with me. Is this really the big debate amongst libertarians? Because it seems to me, I mean, with all due respect, because, like, I mean, the reason why I feel like I'm indulging in this line of question is because if we can get to a number that we can relatively agree upon, and you can tell me how you get to that half, 0.5%, but if we can get to a number that is 30%, 40%, 20%, seems to me, then any argument that we have government taxation or regulation that inhibits things to 20 or 30%, if that's already our starting point with libertarianism, I'm feeling really good about that. Because at the end of the day, I don't really care about the philosophical underpinnings of this stuff. I'm looking for policies in the real world that I think are good. So if you're going to say it's a half a percent, 2 million based upon 300 million today. I'm just curious, what is it? Where do you fall on that? Is it the fence? Is it every yard you need to have a corn? Do you need to chop a tree every 6 feet or 12 feet? Or how does that work?
Well, I'm trying to explain that to you. But before I do, let me just say that we're agreeing on the principle. I agree with you that if the native Indians homesteaded 40% of the land, or 60 or 80% or whatever it is, then they should have 40 or 60 or 80% of the land. So we have no dispute.
I'm just stipulating,
on principle.
Make no mistake, I'm just stipulating for, you know, to explore your philosophy.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, then provisionally. I should put the word provisionally. Look, we agree on 100% of the slave lands, do we not? Those plantations that were really homesteaded by the slaves under the whip of the overseers?
I actually think that the reparations should be broader than those people, direct descendants, frankly.
Okay. Well, we have that. You see, the argument this guy Horowitz argued with a black scholar at Harvard, I think, who said, I think what you're now saying is that, you know, all whites owe all blacks something for slavery. And here I agree with Horowitz, who says, well, you know, there were a lot of blacks who came after slavery was over. Why should they get anything? And there are a lot of whites, Jews, for example, who never had slaves. And also there were blacks who had slaves. So I wouldn't go any further than that, but I think you and I agree on 100% of the land, at least. We agree
well,
on that.
I
you
wouldn't
want to go further.
I don't get there for the same reasons you do, but that's not important in the context of this. I'm just curious as to, like, how, you know, I was just pursuing a question as to how it is that you perceive property rights, not the exercise of property rights, and I'm talking about the property rights that aren't innate to one by being born, okay? How you exercise those property rights without exercising aggression, because, you know, I walk into a house, if I don't recognize it's your house, and or better yet, let's just keep it a piece of land. I walk onto this piece of land, I don't recognize your authority, wherever it comes from, to own that land, and you attack me. As far as I'm concerned, you're being aggressive. But you're saying the way that I have got the authority to own that land is because I've worked it, because I've mixed my labor with it. And now I'm asking you, okay, what are the parameters of that? Because, hey, you're about to exercise violence on me, aggression on me, but you're saying the reason why it's not aggressive is because you have a legitimate claim to that property, and I'm trying to figure out, how did you get that legitimate claim? You tell me by working it, and I go, what do you mean?
Right. Now, it's a fair question. And by the way, how I get the 0.5% is I put 2 million Indians in the numerator, and I put 350 million people in the denominator, and I get 2/350, which is, I don't know, 1/3% or something like that. Just a rough and ready estimate.
So it would have been better for the Native Americans to have this conversation 100 years ago.
Well, no, even 100 years ago, they never owned more than 2% of anything because there were so few of them, and they couldn't possibly homestead vast
areas.
Well,
wait a second. Your numerator changes, though, right? I mean, 100 years ago.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, no. The numerator changes 100 years. In other words, there were 2 million Indians when we white people, I don't think your ancestors or mine were there then, but when we white people came, there were 2 million. We killed an awful lot of them, so the numerator decreases, but I'm willing to keep the numerator up to as many people as there were before they were slaughtered by the white people.
That's mighty white of you, as we would say.
So to speak. You should say so to speak. Look, the point is, as to the intensivity or the extensivity of the homesteading, it depends upon the culture. East of the Mississippi, you have to be more intensive. West of the Mississippi, less intensive. When we go to the moon and we start using the Lockean homesteading theory, we would even be less intensive because it's a desert. So, you just chop down a tree every 20 feet or there are no trees on the moon. But the point is that east of the Mississippi, you have to plant those corn plants as the way most people plant the corn plants. Namely, it's based on the culture. And I guess that's every foot or every yard or something like that.
Well, what if the Native American culture was such that, we just walk across it and anything that we can see.
Too bad. Too bad on them. That's not libertarian. Anything you can see. Then Columbus, let's say there were no Indians where Columbus was, and he gets up on a big ladder and he sees 100 square miles. Well, if that's his culture, the libertarians would
just
reject
it. Well, I'm saying
it.
If they're the first ones to see it. Or
too
we
bad.
Use it as part of our – I cut down this tree here so that I can see the valley. Haven't I worked it? Haven't I mixed that that view shed with my labor?
No. Vision is not good enough to own things. You have to actually mix your labor with the land.
But we still are. And that depends on which side of the Mississippi you're on as to what that is.
Well,
I mean, this doesn't seem like a system to me. It seems a little bit arbitrary.
Well, there's a system here if you look at it more sympathetically. Namely, you look at how the people actually farm. And let's say they come from Ireland and or Britain or France or wherever. And how do they farm there? Well, they put plants, corn plants, every foot. Well, then, given that the eastern Mississippi is sort of like France in terms of having a certain amount of water, well, then you follow that policy. So there is a system, and the system does not allow you to own as far as you can see, and it doesn't allow you to own, you know, you put a corn plant every acre. You put a corn plant every acre, you own the foot around each corn plant, but you don't own the whole acre. So there is a system. It's, I wouldn't say it's arbitrary, but I would say it's a continuous sort of a thing. Mm. We have a continuum problem. Let me talk about the continuum problem for a second, if I may.
Sure.
If you go to bed with a 5-year-old girl, you're guilty of statutory rape, even if she agrees, because we don't think that she is capable of agreement. On the other hand, if you go to bed with a 25-year-old woman and she agrees, we don't think it's statutory rape, because we think that women of 25 years old are perfectly capable of giving consent. Well, what about the 15-year-old girl? Oh, what about the 14 or the 16? You know, where is the right point to have statutory rape? And the answer coming from me, and I think most people, is it's sort of a continuum. It's arbitrary. If you pick 15 years and 6 months, well, how about 15 years and 7 months? There's no one right answer. And that's the sort of a thing that is occurring in how intensive or extensive does the homesteading have to be. You just can't say, well, it has to be this extensive or it has to be that. But we know that a 5-year-old girl is way over on one side of the line and a 25-year-old girl is way over on the other side of the line, just as we know that if you put one plant every square mile, you're not homesteading. And if you put one plant every foot than you are, and well, how about every half acre, or how about every quarter acre? It's a continuum problem.
See,
there's no right answer,
now,
or rather, there's no non-arbitrary answer, but it's not an arbitrary system.
See, I think this gets to the heart of one of the things that I find most problematic about libertarianism, is that I agree with you. The where we draw the line in terms of statutory rape is arbitrary. It's simply in our society, we find it at one point. In another society or at another time, it could be at a different point. It is a determination that is made in many respects by, I mean, I guess sort of it is arbitrary and subjective. And that's the thing that I ultimately find about libertarianism, is that at the end of it, once you get down to the basis, someone has decided – or someone has decided on what measure, arbitrarily or based upon, you know, and by arbitrarily, I'm not saying whimsically, but I'm saying based upon whatever their culture says, that this is going to be the legitimate property right in this instance, or this is going to be the legitimate use of aggression. And it is arbitrary. And despite the fact that libertarians ultimately say this is simply just a logical construct, at one point it's just where a libertarian wants to decide to sort of plant the flag. In this case, this is where we're going to decide property is legitimate. And this is where we're going to decide that the use of force is legitimate. And that's why I think, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, I find it, you know, it's interesting to talk about, but it's really just not useful beyond the fact that we've decided on X and that's what X is going to be. And, you know, I think that is, you know, often like a function of a democracy, and hopefully the democracy is working. I think there are times where we can have these calculations made because there's a failure of democracy. But again, that's just my arbitrary perspective. And then, you know, you let it hash out. But it seems like libertarians try and rely on some sense that there's a logical these things follow logically. But there is, at the end of the day, you've got to just make an arbitrary decision.
Well, I think if I'm going to convert you to libertarianism, it's going to be consequentialist or utilitarian libertarianism, not deontological, because even though you do have a flair for the logic and the reductio ad absurdum, I think at bottom you're really a consequentialist or utilitarian. And by that, I don't mean to criticize you.
I don't take it as one.
No, good. You know, in our email, we said we would talk about other things besides property, and all so far
I'm
we've
sorry.
Only talked
well,
about
let's,
property.
Let's,
we've only, like, we were going to talk about vaccinations or minimum wage or things like that, but we're almost out of time, so we're probably not going to get to that. But I just wanted to say that I hope you invite me back on your program, because most of the interviews I do are with libertarians doing the finer points of libertarianism, and which is roughly what we did today. But I think in future, if we discuss other issues such as vaccinations or minimum wage or whatever, you won't be roughly being so interested in internal libertarian discussions. And another point is, you see, I've been defending the anarchist libertarian position, and you don't much like that. I think if I'm going to convert you to libertarianism, it's going to be as a minarchist, because then minarchists believe in democracy, they believe in national governments, they believe in all these sorts of things. And the solution to how intensive or extensive the homesteading would have to be under the minarchist or the constitutionalist would be, well, the Supreme Court ultimately, or maybe each state court, and I think that would be something you'd be much more comfortable with.
Certainly more comfortable than not, but I would even go even beyond minarchists to what we needists is what I basically come down on.
That's a good one. What we need is.
Let's touch on vaccines. It's been in the news. I don't know. I know that in the past that you were an advisor for Congressman Ron Paul. I don't know if you're an advisor to Senator Rand Paul. But he had some comments about vaccines the other day. And I'm curious as to what your perspective is on vaccinations.
Well, with all due respect to you, not as a philosopher, but as a, I don't know, as a radio host, we've only got a few minutes, and that issue is probably worth a whole hour too, but since you ask, I'll give you the 1 minute answer. And that is that among libertarians, there's a big dispute. Oh, yes, I am sort of an indirect advisor to Rand Paul as well through one of his top lieutenants. My view is, that at least in some cases, now I don't know about measles, it would depend upon the specifics, that it would be justified to compel people to have vaccinations or inoculations or whatever, whereas most libertarians, Rand Paul and Ron Paul and pretty much everyone who writes for LouRockwell.com and whoever writes for Target Liberty, they take a different view than me, and they take the view that it, you know, it's up to the parent or something like that.
Oh, so you you do, I mean, and yeah, this is all sort of stipulated on the notion that vaccinations are safe, you know, which, you know, obviously there's some people disagree. I don't. But that vaccinations are safe. So you have no problem. And like do you, so when you advise Rand Paul on this or through one of his lieutenants, as you say, is it on libertarian terms or is it just simply on public policy terms?
Both. Both.
What is the libertarian terms?
Well, the way on vaccinations, you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, to me, take the case of Typhoid Mary. Now, Typhoid Mary lacked mens rea. Mens rea is like a guilty conscience. She wasn't trying to give people typhoid. She didn't even know she had typhoid, but she was in some sort of restaurant or food bank or whatever, and she was giving people typhoid. So the question is, do we forget about anarchist libertarianism for the moment? Does the government, a legitimate, limited government, have the right to go to her and say, look, Typhoid Mary, you are not a murderer, or at least not a first-degree murderer because you lack intent, but you are engaging in manslaughter, and we've got to stop you. Now, you're not guilty. You're not a bad guy, so we're not going to put you in jail. We're going to put you in a nice hotel room or something, or and we'll, you know, feed you and give you a TV set if they had TVs in those days or whatever, and, you know, we'll get you food and clothing or whatever. But you got to stay out of circulation. You've got to be quarantined as long as you have it. Would they be justified in doing that? I would say yes. And I extrapolate from that and say, look, you know, measles, Mary, you now have measles, and there are certain people who can't be inoculated, like pregnant women and babies under the age of 1 year old. And if you, you know, go out into the streets, you're going to give these people measles or mumps or whatever it is, rubella. And some of these people are going to die. And do we have a right to use violence against you defensively? Because remember, we're not pacifists, and I would say yes.
Wow.
But
well,
Sam, I
Professor, I got to say, I think you and I are in agreement on that. And it really,
hey.
I think it puts into relief on some level. I mean, because I consider, I mean, you are by your own accord on the most pure end of the spectrum of libertarians. And it seems to me you're significantly more moderate on this point than Rand Paul.
Well, I wouldn't say moderate. I would say I'm more
reasonable,
compatible, or consistent with the libertarian principle than he is. But again, I'm in the distinct minority among libertarians. Most libertarians wouldn't agree with me. But again, I don't say that it's true in the case of measles. I would say if the science were clear, and I'm not scientist enough. But Sam, I got to get off.
Oh yes, okay.
On
Professor,
1 hour.
Thank you so much.
And as I say, I hope you invite me again because I really enjoyed this, and I'd like to get out and talk to people that don't agree with me also.
Well, I appreciate your coming on, and I'm sure we will talk again soon.
Great. Have a good day.
Bye bye. Well, so there it is. We finished on a point of agreement.
This was a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, the I hope it's fair that I comment on these. I imagine that he's commenting in his various forums on this. But the idea that property rights are legitimate, that come down to the distance between where you plant the corn or you chop down a tree, and that is a function of which side of the Mississippi River you were on, I think sort of, in my mind, illustrates the point that I have been making over and over again to libertarians who call in, is that at one point or another, you're making an arbitrary decision. And you could say I'm doing it on the mores of corn planting in France, or I am doing it on the methodology of trailblazing by Irish Scotsmen, not Native Americans, but you're still arbitrarily saying, hey, this is where I decide property rights will be legitimate, and then my use of force will be legitimate. And of course, I also think that the idea that we're going to have at least we're all going to have our own individual courts, or we're going to sign up for courts, and then those courts will band together and agree to go to other courts, which I guess presumably will go to other courts. And it's all at the end of the day just going to be cemented by who can afford it. I don't think that's a recipe for a very good society. But I would submit that they basically tried this back in the in what Matt would call the Game of Thrones days.
The whole time during that interview, I just have in a loop in my head now, like, that would depend on acorn acreage in the pre-colonial settlement.
All right, we're going to take a break. Head into the fun half where I will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. To get your feelings, and we have a lot of IMs to read about this debate. We've got some news. I have a feeling I'm going to end up getting to that tomorrow. Reminder, this show relies upon the support of you, you who's listening right now. And some of you go like, oh, that's right. I remember signing up. And there's others going, what's he talking about? I just listen to the show. I don't support it. Well, then I'm talking about the latter. Or I should say I'm talking about the former, and I'm also talking to the latter in terms of what you should do. You can become a member at majority.fm or join the Majority Report. Also, if you drink coffee and you believe that people should get fair wages, even though they may have been, even though they only constitute 0.5% of, if you divide them by, or you you divide them into today's population, or even 100 years ago's population, if you believe people should get a fair wage for their work, and you like the idea of a cooperative
business and you like the idea of getting 10% off, then justcoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off your coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. And if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to skim some off of Jeff Bezos' profits and give it to the Majority Report by going to majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your crap from there. We get a kickback, thus majorityreportkickback.com. We'll be right back, 646-257-3920. You can IM us at Majority FM. We'll be right back.